Dedicated to the survival of American democracy in an increasingly dangerous world, this is Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney, acted as Assistant Secretary of Defense for International Security Policy under President Ronald Reagan, founder and president of the Center for Security Policy in Washington, D.C., the go-to man for defense and foreign policy issues, joined by the greatest minds in the security policy business, the special forces in the war of ideas at Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.
Welcome to Secure Freedom Radio. This is Frank Gaffney, your host. I will be escorting you about what I think of as the battle space of the war for the free world with three really extraordinary people who are involved in various aspects of the fight. We'll be speaking in segment two with Azra Nomani. She is a Muslim who has stood up against the tyranny of Sharia and efforts, among other things, by its adherents to dismember or at least neutralize one of the most effective police departments in the United States, especially when it comes to counterterrorism, the one protecting New York City, the New York Police Department. We'll get her thoughts on why Muslims should be standing with her and not with the Muslim Brotherhood, which is trying to do that dismantling. In segment three, we'll speak with Dr. Robert Zubrin, one of our country's leading authorities on energy security and what we need to remedy the dreadful state of vulnerability that we currently experience. He'll also be talking about a brand new book, Merchants of Despair, Radical Environmentalists, Criminal Pseudoscientists, and the Fatal Cult of Anti-Humanism, published tomorrow. Segment four will be our visit with Gordon Chang, our duty guy on Asian matters. We'll be speaking about some important developments inside the Communist Party of China. Is it the beginning of the unraveling that he's been anticipating with us? Also, North Korean, Chinese, and Iranian missile programs and what they represent in terms of a threat, not just to the people of those countries, perhaps, but certainly to others in their regions and beyond, including quite possibly us here in the United States. So all of that lies ahead. But first, I want to share with you some thoughts about a vote that's going to be held in the Senate tomorrow, assuming the schedule holds. And that is a vote on whether to reauthorize an entity of the United States government known as the U.S. Export-Import Bank. And the U.S. Export-Import Bank, better known as EXIM, serves as a very important instrument for increasing the sale of American-made products, particularly manufactured products, around the world by enabling foreign customers to obtain loans for the purchase of such equipment or supplies at rates that are guaranteed by the United States government. This is a facet of government activity in the modern age in which all of our competitors in international commerce basically engage. They have similar facilities in their countries that help ensure that their products can be competitive on the global market. This is especially important for the United States, as our products, our industrial base, has been severely attrited over the years. In fact, our automotive manufacturers and our aircraft manufacturers are, broadly speaking, the last bastions of modern American productive capacity when it comes to industrial manufacturing. This is something we dare not allow to be attrited further, and as a result, I'm very much hoping that when the Senate votes tomorrow, they will reauthorize this Export-Import Bank and increase the size of its essential line of credit, its ability to exercise loan guarantees, to $140 billion from the present $100 billion. Now, there are critics, some of them good friends of mine, who argue otherwise, who think that we should not be in the business of subsidizing manufacturing industries, that we shouldn't be picking winners and losers, as they often say, that we should be essentially allowing the private sector to provide credit as is needed for these sorts of transaction, which they argue amount to crony capitalism at a time when we can't frankly afford to be issuing such loans. Well, I think there's some misunderstanding of what the Export-Import Bank actually is doing, that indeed the money-making activity that's engaged here, not money costing, is one of the attractions for me of the Export-Import Bank. It is, according to one estimate, returned $400 million to the Treasury in 2011 alone. And since 2005, according to the Chamber of Commerce, actually returned something on the order of $3.4 billion over and above, you know, its costs and the reserves that it has to hold in order to guarantee against default. And the default rate, by the way, has only been about 2%. Now, there's some who say, well, we shouldn't be borrowing money from China to make these sorts of loans. And I think at an intellectual level, I take that point. But as a practical matter, if we're able to make more money than it costs us borrowing from the Chinese, then this may be one of the few areas where it makes sense for us to be doing such borrowing. The point is that the Exim Bank is reducing the deficit, not adding to it. Second, I believe, far from picking winners and losers, the Export-Import Bank loan guarantees simply ensure that we have a chance to have any winners at all in the international marketplace. We are effectively leveling the playing field with those foreign governments who, as I mentioned earlier, are only too happy to provide credit. For example, the Chinese have a facility for this kind of work that is 11 times the size of the Export-Import Bank. And this enables, by removing what could otherwise be a real disadvantage for our companies, the excellence of our products to be the determinant of whether they prevail in the marketplace, not our rival's sweetheart financial arrangement. Third, there is already an existing U.S. Congress mandate for the Export-Import Bank to focus on lending to small businesses. And as a result, 87% of the bank's transactions have gone to such enterprises, including the small businesses, which are, of course, among those that have been hardest hit by the credit crunch of recent years. Now, to be sure, some of the largest of the loan guarantees have gone to big companies, notably Boeing, our last remaining aerospace manufacturer for commercial aviation. But the truth of the matter is that this is only one of the places where we are seeing significant investment made through the support that's being provided by Exim Bank in our nation's industrial base, especially the aerospace part of that industrial base. And that's particularly important, it seems to me, and I hope to others who are minded of the serious harm being done to that national security asset, our aerospace industrial base, as a result of the deep cuts, draconian cuts, that are now taking place in the defense sector. We must not allow, at the same time that those cuts are taking place, these aerospace manufacturing concerns, both Boeing as the prime and its many, many subsidiaries around the country, to go down simply because their products can't enjoy the kind of loan guarantees that their competitors are now providing. I would argue that we need also to be making sure that there is rigorous oversight of the Export-Import Bank. It has in the past funded people who are not necessarily friendly to us. In fact, it was not until 2009 that the Export-Import Bank put in place a rule requiring borrowers to certify that they have no operations in Iran's energy sector. That kind of oversight, coupled with a reauthorization and the additional loan guarantee capability, is needed now. I hope the Senate will go ahead and provide it. And if they do, I think we will find the United States economy and our budget deficit the better. Next up, we'll be talking with a remarkable Muslim woman about her fight against extremism in her community. Straight ahead.
First line of defense in the war of ideas. Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.
I was able to lose the 80 pounds I gained due to pregnancy. It was pretty easy to eat whatever I wanted and not think about it.
The Meta System from Judy Singer has been helping make weight loss easier for a quarter century.
My husband's grandmother used it 20 years ago to lose weight for a wedding and said it was the only way to go.
The Meta System also has an excellent support staff.
They were very supportive. The first time that I ordered the product, they called me and suggested that I order a lower dosage to begin with. They didn't want me to jump the gun right off the bat, and it was nice to know that they actually cared.
And the weight loss is so dramatic, people wonder.
With the Meta System, I've got many questions about how I managed raising a baby and working full-time and lose the weight and eat whatever I wanted.
People who use it recommend it.
I suggested the Meta System to my mother, and she has lost 30 pounds.
Learn more about weight loss with Judy Singer's The Meta System by calling 800-711-JUDY, 800-711-JUDY. The Meta System from Judy Singer, the powerful all-natural way to lose weight, 800-711-JUDY.
The first step in winning a war is to know whom you're fighting. 9 years after 9/11, the U.S. security establishment has failed to tell us. The very words we need to describe the war are being outlawed. We went from the war on terror under Bush to the war on man-made disasters under Obama. Neither identifies the threat doctrine behind the aggression, Islamic Sharia law. That's why the Center for Security Policy assembled Team B, an independent group of national security professionals, including Bill Clinton's Director of Central Intelligence, James Woolsey. The result is a book that challenges the assumptions of the current administration and exposes the supremacist nature of Sharia and the jihad its adherents are obliged to engage in. This report names the names of those responsible and makes plain the mortal peril now posed to America's Constitution, our national security, and way of life. For more information, visit ShariaTheThreat.com or order your copy of Sharia, The Threat to America at Amazon.com.
Experts say there's no shortage of crude oil.
There really is no shortage of oil at the moment.
So why do gasoline prices keep going up?
There's all this fear that's out there, and that really goes a long way to making prices go up.
And home prices seem to be headed even lower.
We really aren't seeing any markets that are showing any sustained recovery at this point.
Now more than ever, is this a timeout or a double dip?
We could halt the economy's recovery in its tracks.
1260 WRC. New choice, intelligent talk.
You're listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney from the nation's capital in Washington, D.C.
We're back, joined by Azra Nomani, a woman who I have been following with great interest for some time. She is the author of Standing Alone, An American Woman's Struggle for the Soul of Islam. She teaches at Georgetown University. She has been leading the Pearl Project, which is a faculty student investigation into the murder of Wall Street Journal reporter Daniel Pearl. And she has also been involved in a film back in the day when I was also making a film in connection with a Corporation for Public Broadcasting competition. It was called, I believe, A Mosque in West Virginia. And most recently, Asra Nomani has been heard defending the New York Police Department, which has come in for a lot of criticism of late from Muslim Americans concerned that its surveillance activities and more generally counterterrorism initiatives are infringing upon Muslims' rights. For all these reasons, Asra Nomani, I'm delighted to welcome you to Secure Freedom Radio. Thank you so much for joining us, and thanks for what you've been doing to try to help define an alternative view from that, say, of the the Muslim Brotherhood here in the United States at the moment.
Thank you so much.
Let's talk a little bit about NYPD as a sort of point of departure. You have expressed, well, solidarity, I guess, is one way of describing it, with the best in the business in the United States at the moment, very much at odds with some of the positions of others taken in the Muslim community. Tell us what your thoughts are on it and what kind of response you've gotten from other Muslims.
Well, I agree with what you're saying because I knew the streets of New York in the 1970s when they weren't so clean and they weren't so safe. I was a little girl, just came from India, and we were living in New Brunswick, New Jersey, and my family would always go into Manhattan, and you knew to keep your doors locked. You knew that you never knew whether your stuff would still be in the car when you came back. We got things stolen a lot. And I've seen their evolution also, just as a citizen of the country. And, you know, concurrently, through that same evolution, I've seen this alarming phenomena in my Muslim community where this ideology of Islam has been exported from Saudi Arabia from the 1970s, from that same time period that I was growing up in, wandering around the streets of New York with my mom and dad. And I see those as parallel journeys. You know, I see that, it very much informs what I believe today, which is that we need a police force that is vigilant about this issue of extremism in our Muslim communities, and that we shouldn't use religion as a cover to keep the police from looking at mosques, Muslim organizations, or places where Muslims gather. Just as we would have no limitations, I hope, on looking at issues of the Italian mafia or the Colombian drug cartel, you know, things that are very much associated with specific ethnicities also.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I think this was in an interview with Fox News. You described how, quote, we use religion as a cover. We're saying that you can't go into our mosques, you can't look at our Muslim organizations, you can't even look at Muslims because that's to target us. But the truth is we do have a problem in our Muslim community, unquote. How would you characterize it? You've mentioned sort of the ideology of Saudi Arabia. In my own studies of this, I've sort of concluded that the distilled essence of that ideology is what its adherents call Sharia, which is not to say, you know, the practice, the personal pietistic practice that many Muslims think of as Sharia, but sort of the political program that is, as you say, at work in some of these mosques and many of the Muslim American organizations, particularly those associated with the Brotherhood. How would you describe it, Azra Nomani, as the essence of the problem in our Muslim community?
Well, I think the essence of the problem is interpretation over Islamic law, and that is called Sharia. And unfortunately, you know, Sharia has had the translation as divine law, but if we really look at it, it's man-made law, just like many of the interpretations of religion have been over the centuries. I mean, let's be completely fair and honest, right? And I know that your audience and you are intellectually honest about, you know, the challenges that all societies have faced. There was a time when Christian groups and Christians used the Bible to sanction slavery, right, and segregation. I mean, it was religiously endorsed as much as anything else. Well, Christian community has evolved to the point where they don't have that interpretation anymore. And we, unfortunately, have a struggle inside of our community where we still have an interpretation that is very prevalent that says that women have to cover their faces with their veils, that, you know, men and women can't mix, that you should have, you know, these horrific punishments for things like sex crimes, stoning and cutting off of hands for theft and, you know, crime for women who've been gang raped, you know, just all of these totally regressive interpretations. And so that's our struggle. And, you know, while ordinary Muslims may practice a type of interpretation of Sharia that is not, you know, going to interfere with the rest of society, there are those that do. And I have the same worries that people who aren't Muslim have about the intrusion of those interpretations on my life, because They don't like the way I live. Our interview might be interrupted by my puppy that I got last year barking. Because Lily, you know, is living in my home. She's in the kitchen. She has her little space. And she wanders through the house. And there's an interpretation of Islam that says that the Prophet Muhammad told us that an angel will not visit a house in which a dog resides. Mm-hmm. And so
they're haram, in other words.
Yeah, they're haram or illegal. Mm-hmm. Yeah, okay, so that's the interpretation that I grew up with. And I have a little 9-year-old boy, and this is last summer I was like, you know what, we need a puppy in our lives. Mm. And we got the puppy. There's only one school of jurisprudence of the four that accepts dogs as pets. Well, you know, this is haram then. This is a haram house to many Muslims. Mm. But my father prays regularly. I have a house guest now who actually covers her hair. And we accept change and evolution, and that's where we're at. We're from the personal to the mundane, like having a puppy, to the political, like whether you wage war in the West. No, that's our battle.
I'll reintroduce our guest is Azra Nomani. She is a former reporter for the Wall Street Journal. She was a close colleague and friend of Daniel Pearl. In fact, it was from her home that Daniel Pearl was last seen as he went off to meet Islamists who wound up killing him in the most brutal fashion. She's the author of Standing Alone, An American Woman's Struggle for the Soul of Islam. And Azra, tell us just very briefly, if you would, about Muslims for Peace, a group that you helped organize back in 2006.
Well, we were a group of moms who came together literally around a dining table, and we realized that we needed a new image for Islam in the world. And, you know, this wasn't to pull the wool over anyone's eyes, as I understand people rightfully are suspicious, but really to reflect our ordinary lives as moms that want to have raise our kids with peace in this country. Mm-hmm. And so the vision for these moms was just that. I got to say that story ends interestingly, though, because a couple of the moms were involved with the effort to build the mosque near Ground Zero. Mm-hmm. And I had a difference of opinion with them. Mm. I thought that we needed to actually respect the wishes of people and not build that mosque there at Ground Zero. And so I actually left the group, not because I didn't believe in the principles of it, but because I just didn't believe in that vision that they had to build that mosque there. And I also didn't believe in the developers. And so, you know, we continue. I'm not affiliated with the group anymore with a capital letter on peace, but with a small letter. And, you know, that's the bigger mission that I've got, is just to put an interpretation of Islam out there in the world that believes in coexistence and tolerance and women's rights.
Right. Well, Azra Nomani, we have to let you go. I know that this is probably a thankless task, but let me thank you for doing it. We need more Muslims like you in this country who I'm quite confident feel as you do, to speak up as you have and to really help counter what is happening within your community and as a result that threatens all of us. Thank you for joining us. It's always great to talk with you, and I look forward to doing so again very soon. And next up, we'll be speaking with Robert Zubrin about energy insecurity. Straight ahead.
We want to know what you think here at Secure Freedom Radio. Leave your comments or questions for us at 1-800-332-7131.
Go to SecureFreedomRadio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio.
Hey, parents. Finding it hard to communicate with kids in today's world of ever-changing slang?
Hi, son.
Excuse me?
Introducing the Communicizer. Just strap non-toxic Communicizer to your mouth and go from boring old man speak.
You know, I'm here if you want to talk.
To 100% off the chain.
Text me whenever, yo.
It's that easy.
Thanks to Communicizer, I'm relevant to my kids again. I mean, a fly, boo.
And now when you buy Communicizer, you get the auto-tune attachment free. Sounds so hip-hop, your kids will want to talk to you for hours.
I used to have to walk 3 miles uphill to school every morning, shorty.
I love you, Dad.
I love you too, son.
Communicizer is not available in stores because it doesn't exist. But that's okay. You don't have to be perfect to be a perfect parent. Because kids in foster care don't need perfection. They need you. For more information on how you can adopt, go to AdoptUsKids.org. A public service announcement from the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services, Adopt Us Kids, and the Ad Council.
For decades, the Democratic Republic of Congo has endured economic collapse, poverty, and war. More than 3.5 million people have died in the conflict. Today, rebel forces continue to wreak havoc in the eastern Kivu provinces. The International Rescue Committee estimates that 30,000 children have been recruited as soldiers, and thousands more have lost their parents. Most of these children lack the most basic level of goods, security, and most especially, clean drinking water. Yet, there is a well of hope coming to eastern Congo in a village called Uvira. Washington, D.C.'s National Community Church is partnering with Global Outreach to bring a water pipeline to the Congo for Christ compound, an orphanage for children who have lost their parents to war and AIDS. Building a clean water source will sustain the school, provide for the children, and hundreds more in the village. Go to www.waterforcongo.com. Learn about the work of Global Outreach and give. You can be part of the community in Uvira, and like a well, you can be a source of hope in life. www.waterforcongo.com.
Hi, I'm Drew Brees, NFL quarterback for the New Orleans Saints, here with Bugs Bunny to remind you to get moving every day.
Because when you get moving an hour a day,
you fuel your body and your mind.
So what do you like to throw around the football like Drew?
Skateboard.
Play frisbee in the park.
Ride a bike.
Kick the soccer ball around.
Or dance in your room.
Just move it your way.
Because nothing makes you feel better than moving every day.
And that makes you part of a winning team.
So be a player.
You'll have more energy to do the things you like to do.
Move it your way and be a player.
Get up and play an hour a day, Doc. Check out how to be a player at letsmove.gov.
Head online to get tips on great ways to get moving every day.
That's right, at letsmove.gov. Let's hear that one more time, Doc. That's www.letsmove.gov. A message from the Ad Council and HHS.
Following is an important message from President Clinton and President Bush.
In January, Haiti experienced an environmental catastrophe and human tragedy of epic proportion.
But thanks in part to the generous spirit of the American people, the country of Haiti has survived. But now the people need to thrive. President Clinton and I have seen firsthand the power of your contributions at work.
The Clinton-Bush Haiti Fund is on the ground, funding programs that create jobs, teach skills, and assist local businesses.
Our fund is dedicated to supporting initiatives that encourage local entrepreneurs and help build an inclusive economy that lifts up everyone.
Help us continue this work so the people of Haiti have an opportunity to prosper.
Thank you.
To donate, go to ClintonBushHaitiFund.org or text QUAKE to 20222 to give $10. Message and data rates may apply. Brought to you by the Clinton Bush Haiti Fund and the Ad Council.
Hi, this is Frank Effney. You're listening to Intelligent Talk on WRC 1260 in Washington, D.C.
Now more with Frank Gaffney.
Welcome back. We're joined by Robert Zubrin. He is one of our real go-to guys on national security's energy security component. He is the author of a book that will be published tomorrow entitled Merchants of Despair. It is a subject that he knows a lot about, as it turns out, and we'll be very anxious to hear more about it momentarily, as well as what is the challenge we're facing in terms of our energy insecurity and what can be done about it. But Robert Zubrin, welcome back to Secure Freedom Radio. It's always great to have you with us, and congratulations on the new book.
Well, thanks for inviting me again.
Tell me what Merchants of Despair is about and how it ties in with your larger thesis of what we should be doing to assure the security, energy, and otherwise of the United States.
Well, Merchants of Despair is about environmentalists. A lot of conservatives know and despise environmentalists because of what they've done to damage our economy, constrain free enterprise, and so forth, and that is all true. And therefore, in fact, they've had a devastating role, as we'll discuss later, on our energy security. But in fact, they're part of a larger movement, which I call the anti-human movement. The fundamental thesis of which is that humans are vermin. They are a cancer upon the earth, and thus their activities must be constrained, and therefore someone must be empowered to do the constraining. So it's fundamentally an argument for tyranny. And whether it takes the form of its original form, which is the Malthus theory, that food supplies are limited and therefore the poor must be crushed, or you go through the eugenics movement, certain races are inferior, must be crushed, Nazis who took that to extreme, the population control movement, the environmental movement as such, the global warming movement, which says, okay, resources aren't limited, but the right to use them must be limited. It's all the same thing. So what you're dealing here is a totalitarian movement, and which has a core idea which has taken many different forms. And what the book Merchants of Despair does is it takes this core idea, starting with Malthus back in 1800, and takes it forward through the Irish famine, where relief was forbidden based on the fact that the Irish were allegedly overpopulated, to the eugenics movement, which evolved into the Nazi movement, to the population control movement and the environmentalist movement, which has killed tens of millions of people. The environmentalists, they banned DDT, which as a result, malaria was not suppressed in Africa, and millions of people die every year because of this. Or what they're doing right now with stopping genetically improved foods, where they now have varieties of rice that are rich in vitamin A, and millions of third world children go blind every year from vitamin A deficiency, and this would cure it. But the European Union, led by the Greens, the German Greens, who are a direct outgrowth of the Nazi Party, literally, the founder of the Green Party, August Hausleiter, was a Nazi from the time of the Beer Hall Putsch. They say Europe will not import agricultural goods from any third world country that uses genetically modified crops. And the third worlders can't defy this. And as a result, you've got millions of children going blind. It's incredible. And then finally, the global warming thing, where they want to constrain all economic activity, allegedly because CO2 emissions are bad. CO2 emissions are good. Plants need CO2. We've had a 14% increase in the rate of plant growth worldwide since 1958, and we know that from photographs we've taken from space, precisely because of the CO2 enrichment of the atmosphere due to human activity. If CO2 levels in the atmosphere were falling, that would be a cause for alarm. That would threaten the biosphere. But in fact, we're doing the exact opposite. And the fact that they condemn humanity for doing something good for the biosphere speaks that all they're about is condemning humanity.
Right. Robert Zubrin is our guest. He is the author of a soon-to-be-published book, Merchants of Despair, which he's just been describing with characteristic zeal. I happen to be rather partial to CO2, I must say, Robert, because I believe I expel it, as do most humans at the moment. So prohibiting it or even restricting it seems to me to be ill-advised. Let's turn to your energy security piece, and as you say, this is very much related to the anti-humanist campaign. We're currently now seeing, Robert, in many different aspects, the challenge of assuring energy security, well, countered or impeded or at least challenged by the environmentalists. Fracking for natural gas, as an example, comes to mind, or offshore drilling, and for that matter, nuclear power, and on and on. Where do you come down on the importance of being able, for example, to use fracking to obtain natural gas and turn it into methanol, which, as you've described, is a potential tremendously important fuel for our automobiles and therefore for our energy security?
Yeah, well, I'm all for fracking, and fracking has been a tremendous success. It managed to do an end run, basically, around the environmentalists who, you know, the U.S. oil production peaked in 1970 at 9.5 million barrels a day. It's 5.6 today. It's like half of what it was in 1970. Why? Because the Environmental Protection Agency went into operation in 1970. The rest of the non-OPEC world has tripled their production since 1970. But in terms of fracking, as a result of the success of fracking, we have plentiful natural gas, and the price of natural gas has crashed from $10 per thousand cubic feet to $2 per thousand cubic feet. And this is going to be great as far as electric power and so forth is concerned, but as of right now, it's not convertible into liquid fuel that cars can use, and so it doesn't really affect OPEC. We no longer use oil to generate electricity in this country. What we need is cars that can run on methanol, because methanol can be easily made from natural gas. That's how we make our methanol today, and methanol is selling right now for $1.13 a gallon without any subsidy, and it's a very easy thing. In fact, at this point, it's simply the right software to be put in the car to make it flex fuel and able to run equally well on gasoline, ethanol, or methanol. And methanol is the one that really matters because it's the one that's cheap. And if we had cars that were able to run on methanol, we'd be able to use our cheap natural gas that we're getting from fracking to invade the automobile fuel market and basically crush OPEC.
Mm-hmm. Now, Robert Zubrin, let me ask you this. You've written about this in America's Energy Disaster at National Review Online. The extent to which we are failing to do as you've urged here with respect to methanol seems to be having the effect of causing natural gas prices, as you say, to crater, and therefore people who in the business of exploiting through fracking and other means natural gas reserves in this country to pull back, which would mean ultimately contraction of the supply, increase in the price, and so on. To what extent could we be doing something about this methanol play right now, keep those people in the business, and ensure that we actually are breaking the back of OPEC? I mean, is this something that we could be doing something about right now? And if so, what is it?
Yes, there's been a bill that has been introduced into the House and Senate with an amazing spectrum of bipartisan support, ranging from people like Maria Cantwell, a liberal Democrat in the Senate, to people like Alan West, a Tea Party Republican in the House, who support a bill that would simply require that the automakers enable the flex fuel capability of most of their new cars sold in the United States. This wouldn't cost them anything. It would save the United States about $500 billion a year, because that's what we're paying for oil imports. And you have to understand, this is the number one strategic issue that this country faces. During World War II, as I discussed in the article, which appeared in National Review last week, the United States alone produced 60% of all the oil produced in the entire world. We produced half again as much oil as the entire rest of the world put together. That's why we won. We were able to bomb and destroy the Nazi oil facilities with impunity because we didn't need their oil. We were able to sink the Japanese tanker fleet and cut them off from Indonesian oil because we didn't need that oil. We could eliminate all the Axis oil from the world market and didn't feel it a thing, and they became completely immobilized. Last German panzer offensive literally ran out of gas right on the battlefield in the Ardennes. And but here we are. We're facing Iran. Okay? You want to stop Iran? Bomb Karg Island. That's their oil export terminal. It exports 80% of their oil. Okay, it's totally vulnerable. It's not under 250 feet of concrete. It's all these huge oil tanks right out in the open, you know, 20 JDAMs, and the place becomes an inferno.
Robert Zubrin, we have to leave it with that provocative thought.
But we can't do it, okay, because we need their oil.
We need their oil, and we've got to change the circumstances under which we do. Robert Zubrin has the right idea. Energy Victory is one of his other books, which I commend you, as well as his writing in National Review Online. And, of course, check out Merchants of Despair tomorrow. Robert Zubrin, thanks so much for joining us. Keep up the good work. We'll talk with you again very soon.
Went from a size 18 down to a size 5, and I was able to keep it off.
Angie had some serious challenges.
I had gone through a divorce and put on quite a bit of weight. There was an accident where I was put on a lot of medication, and I put on over 60 pounds. I tried every kind of diet, but diets just did not work.
Diets don't work is something they hear a lot over at the MetaSystem from Judy Singer.
I heard about Judy Singer's MetaSystem, and I thought, well, you know, couldn't hurt to call. And I called them up, and they told me all about the product, and I thought, well, I'll give it a try. From the first week that I was on it, I wasn't hungry a lot, and it was just amazing. Jumping about 3 months ahead, I dropped 63 pounds.
If you're ready for a natural product that cleanses your system and helps you lose fat, talk to a Judy Singer counselor about the Meta System. Call 1-800-711-JUDY. 1-800-711-JUDY. The Meta System from Judy Singer. Powerful, all-natural weight loss. 1-800-711-JUDY.
Hi, this is Frank Gaffney. My day job is running the Center for Security Policy, which each weeknight brings you this program. But Secure Freedom Radio is just one of the important contributions the Center makes to the common defense. We call our team the Special Forces in the War of Ideas. Like the real Special Forces, we strive to be agile, creative, and highly effective in identifying threats to our country and how they might best be countered. We can't do all this without you, though. Also, like the real Special Forces, ours need ammunition. And in the War of Ideas, ammo is money. The Center is a nonprofit, tax-exempt organization. Contributions to its work are tax-deductible and an important investment in your security and freedom. Find out more about the Center for Security Policy and how you can help keep its Special Forces team in the fight by visiting securefreedom.org. Many thanks.
If your walls could talk, what would they say?
I have held the same mirror for 13 years.
I have been decorated with purple dinosaurs, baseball teams, and football helmets.
I have witnessed 33 Thanksgiving dinners and one wedding proposal.
I have tiny notches marking the growth of three children.
I have caused a learning disability.
I am the reason that a fifth grader simply can't sit still.
I am responsible for a five-year-old's rage.
Just because you can't see lead paint doesn't mean it's not on walls, doors, windows, and sills. Today, lead paint poisoning affects over 1 million children. If your home is built before 1978, your family could be at risk. Let's make all kids lead-free kids. Log on to leadfreekids.org or call 800-424-LEAD.
I am the reason a child has trouble hearing.
If your walls could talk, what would they say?
Brought to you by the Coalition to End Childhood Lead Poisoning, EPA, HUD, and the Ad Council.
Dennis Prager thinks there should be a simple standard to textbooks.
I'll tell you how I think a textbook should be written. This is what happened. Period.
That is the role of the text.
And if nearly everybody who did something important in American history, if 78.9% of them were WASP males, then I want 78.9% of the textbook to reflect that fact.
I care about truth.
That's why I'm not on the left.
The Dennis Prager Show. Well, in the morning and out to school. Weeknights at 10 on 1260 WRC. New Choice, Intelligent Talk.
If you're a veteran of Iraq or Afghanistan, like me, coming home can be harder than expected. I felt a little out of place, but it turns out I wasn't alone.
At IAVA.org, there's a free online community of thousands of OIF and OEF vets who've got your back here, just like they did over there. So now, I'm never alone. I can get the resources I need and talk to tons of people who understand where I'm coming from.
Whether it's navigating the GI Bill,
or VA hospitals,
managing the transition home, or meeting people you can share stories with,
you'll find it at IAVA.org. Even if it's just everyday stuff,
like getting tips on where to find a nice sweater for my dog.
Did he just say that?
Really?
What?
Okay, maybe not that, but everything else. No matter where you are, Iraq and Afghanistan Veterans of America is there for you. Join our community at IAVA.org.
We've got your back.
Brought to you by Iraq Afghanistan Veterans of America and the Ad Council.
Go to securefreedomradio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio.
Welcome back. We are joined, as we have the privilege of being each week, by Gordon Chang for a regular update on what is happening in Asia at the moment. And as ever, there seems to be a lot. Gordon, there's some internal thrashing going on within the Communist Party in China involving American hater by the name of Bo Zhilai. Tell us what's happening with this individual and what the episode that has brought about some rather startling developments as far as his future is concerned mean for us.
On Thursday, Bo Zhilai, who was the Chongqing Party secretary, in other words, the boss of Chongqing, which is a large city in western China, was stripped of that post. He still holds on to other Communist Party seats, but they're not nearly as important. Bo Zhilai is important to us because it says what's going on in the Chinese political system right now. There's a transition as the so-called fourth-generation leaders are supposed to give way to the fifth at the end of this year. Everyone said that it was smooth. everyone except for me, of course. But it has turned out to be very, very tumultuous because while we were watching the Super Bowl last month, Bo was sending essentially an army of hundreds of armed security troops into another province to surround the American consulate in Chengdu in Sichuan province because one of his top lieutenants was trying to defect to the United States, bringing with him documents. And we believe that those documents related to the offshore, in other words, illegal asset of Bo Xilai's wife. There is a lot that we don't know, but we do know that this transition is being is very turbulent right now. It means that the factionalism in the Communist Party is getting worse. The party is splintering. And at the same time, the military is getting more power from all that we can tell.
And Gordon Chang, what does it mean that the United States government surrendered this fellow Wang Lijun, equipped with all of these documents? There was some talk that they've held on to the documents. Do we have any indication what's has happened to them? And again, what is the point in this drama of the U.S. having acceded to demands from Bo and I guess the central authorities as well to surrender this would-be defector?
Yeah, the State Department said that Wang Lijun, who tried to defect to the U.S. consulate in Chengdu, left of his own volition. But it's probably a better story to say that he was not shown a very friendly welcome. He stayed in the consulate for 24 hours. It appears that there must have been some communication between Washington and Beijing about this. And this was just before Xi Jinping's visit to the American capital. So there is an indication that we encouraged him not to stay, encouraged him not to try to defect, because then we would have had to have made a decision on whether to give him asylum.
Yeah, and I gather Vice President Joe Biden was very much involved in this as a man who was anxious to develop this relationship with Xi, the expected new leader of Communist China. Gordon, as this is going on, we've had the Prime Minister of Japan make a pronouncement that sounded very much like Gordon Chang, now that I think of it, warning about the buildup of the Chinese military and its increasing assertiveness. Is this shedding new light on the threat, or is it simply evidence of how concerned China's neighbors are about it? And again, what should we be doing in light of this kind of warning from close ally?
This is not Frank Gaffney warning about China. This is the Japanese prime minister who comes from a party that came to power trying to establish better relationships with Beijing and also trying to distance itself from Washington. But we're now into the third prime minister from the Democratic Party of Japan, and they realize that Beijing is not the friendly nation that they hoped it to be. And so we have been seeing a number of warnings from high Japanese officials in recent months about the problems that Beijing is causing in the region. And what we need to be doing, of course, is trying to strengthen our relationship both with Japan and South Korea, because they're our military allies, and also our friends in the region like Singapore and even Vietnam, because what we're seeing right now is that countries in the region are looking to Washington for help because they realize that they can't contain Beijing on their own. And that's really what needs to be done right now, because Beijing is in this very belligerent and hostile phase, and that the countries in the region can't deal with them on their own.
And the Japanese, of course, are not hallucinating about this. They just had yet another provocation with a Chinese naval vessel in the Senkaku Islands. And, Gordon, you might just explain a little bit of what the historic issue is there and why this is feeding into the kinds of concerns that the Prime Minister of Japan expressed.
Well, the Senkakus are in the East China Sea. When we gave back Okinawa to the Japanese, we also gave back the Senkakus because we seized these during World War II. Most countries believe, and I believe this to be the case, that Japan has a much better claim to the Senkakus than China does. Matter of fact, when Mao Zedong was running China, he acknowledged that the Senkakus were Japanese. Now, however, Beijing claims the Senkakus has been sending their ships into waters around those islands and so essentially has created a territorial claim. The United States doesn't take a position on who is right on the territorial claim, But we do say that they are covered by our mutual assistance treaty with Japan, which means we have an obligation to defend them. And so I think really what we need to do right now is to have some pretty tough conversations with Beijing about this, because China's claims to the Senkakus as a legal matter are really weak.
Gordon Chang, move to another related subject in Asia, namely the increasing threat of missiles that the North Koreans are developing, that the Chinese are developing, and reports that these missiles, perhaps both Chinese and North Koreans, are migrating to other potentially very dangerous actors, including Iran.
North Korea announced a missile launch, actually a rocket launch, for next month, but it really is a ballistic missile test. What's important here is that
Now, let me just stop you. Gordon, this is the same North Korea that said they were not going to be doing long-range nuclear or missile tests, rather, as an effort to improve relations with the United States?
This might shock you, Frank, but yes, it's the same North Korea that on the last day of last month agreed for a moratorium on ballistic missile tests. And, you know, a launcher for a satellite, and the North Koreans say they're going to launch a satellite, and a launcher for a warhead are the same. This is a violation of two sets of UN Security Council resolutions from 2006 and 2009 when they tested long-range missiles in those years. So essentially what we've got is North Korea showing the international community that it doesn't want to deal with everyone else in good faith. This is important because North Korea and Iran are cooperating on missiles, so a North Korean test of a ballistic missile is an Iranian test of a ballistic missile. And really what we have is an unholy triangle of North Korea, China, and Iran, because China has been supporting both of its client states. The Chinese have probably been selling long-range ballistic missiles to the Iranians. There's a report to that effect, which is credible because it's consistent with other information that we have, that Chinese enterprises have been selling parts and technology to the Iranians for their missile program. And as well, as we know from WikiLeaks, that during both the Bush and the Obama administrations, we have been asking Beijing to stop shipments of North Korean missiles to Iran that have been transiting through the Beijing airport. But the Chinese have not stopped these missile shipments. So we know that essentially there's an unholy partnership here.
And that indeed China is complicit in arming the Iranians at the very moment when the entire international community is supposedly now agreed that that's undesirable and should not go forward. Gordon, very
not
quickly.
Not only complicit, Frank, but also it's the ringmaster.
Yeah, that's really the key point, Gordon. Very quickly, there have also been reports that the North Koreans may have tested a nuclear weapon for Iran, perhaps as long ago as maybe 2 years ago now. Do you credit that report? Have you seen it? What should we make of it?
Well, we don't know for sure, but we also know that in addition to their missile partnership, North Korea and Iran have essentially a partnership on nuclear weapons. Every time the North Koreans test a nuke, there are Iranians in North Korea to observe. And when the Iranians have been doing a number of things with their weapons programs, we see North Korean observers in Iran. So essentially,
they're joined at the hip.
Joined at the hip.
Yeah, good. Gordon Chang, we have to leave it at that. Thank you so much for this update. As always, keep up the great work at Forbes.com and WorldAffairsJournal.com and also at Fox News, where I know we've caught you just now. God bless you, sir, and we'll talk with you again soon, and we will speak with the rest of you, I hope, tomorrow. Same time, same station. Until then, this is Frank Gaffney. Thanks for listening.
From the nation's capital, you've been listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.